Now, Jim, show this gentleman how you can dance and sing.
That's my attitude towards the Western powers. If you want to say there's no rules, fine. Don't go crying for your mummy when that comes.
America today finds herself in a unique situation. She's the only country in history in a position to become involved in a bloodless revolution.
If America does not respond creatively to the challenge to banish racism, some future historian will have to say that a great civilization died because it lacked the soul and commitment to make justice a reality for all men.
When the system doesn't work for the majority of the people, you gotta change the system.
Hello family, this is your brother Ryan Mary Deese. Welcome to this episode of Class War Battlefield Podcast. Man, you know, I wanted to talk today about the idea of socialism. And I wanted to talk about the idea because I was watching a video on YouTube of from this this woman who's in her mid-30s, a Trump supporter. And this video is older, actually. It was from when Trump was running for president. And she made a mention that she was supporting Trump, and the reason why she was supporting Trump was because she would never support Hillary Clinton. Fine. A lot of Democrats said that. But that she was tired of the, quote, socialist policies of Barack Obama. And this is something that I've heard so many times from conservatives that it's laughable. I mean, it is just utterly, utterly laughable. So today, I want to just talk a bit about socialism. Because we have to get smarter. It is becoming humiliating in this country. And it really is. I've mentioned it before. People in Europe really think that we are dumb because of the notions that we hold when it comes to capitalism and socialism and the role of government and the, quote, welfare state, and that we really don't have a concept of commonwealth over here anymore. And that's taken about 50 years to implant into people's minds. But, and let me actually say this, because the reality is, it's not we. It's a European problem. It's a European-American problem. And I don't count myself, I can't count myself among that because I'd be lying. Black people in this country routinely, I mean, it's in our genetic structure, I would say. We have a commonwealth approach to everything. We see the greater good within the government's role of helping its citizens as its citizens in aggregate, should I say, or its citizen as a whole group. But it is really Europeans who seem to have this notion, and European Americans who have this notion that doing such a thing is negative. Now, it's becoming humiliating just how uninformed and harmful to themselves these people actually are. Now, some of these people will come through and say, you know, when it comes to Donald Trump and their support for Donald Trump, that, oh, well, you know, we just want to burn the system down. We want the system to crash. And that's what they're talking about. But the reality is, it isn't about the system. These people could give two rats crap about the system. They don't think in that way. They don't think in terms of systems. They don't think in terms of how we going to deconstruct this system to erect a new one. And in fact, when you talk to them about the system that they want, the system most often that they want is the same system that we have now. It's just they want to be in control of it. They don't want the system to change. They just want who's in control to change. And they never say that they will act differently than the people who are in control. In fact, from their outright rejection of socialism, communism, egalitarianism, or anything that is fundamentally different and radically different than capitalism, which socialism does not have to be radically different than capitalism. But from their rejection, they are telling everybody that if they were in the position of the richest people in this country, they wouldn't do anything different. They would do everything the same as the rich people are doing it now. They would treat people the way that those rich folks are treating us, and they wouldn't even care. They don't care about the system. The system is fine. It's just they're not in control of it. And this is massively important. Massively important. Because these folks, to show you how, and look, I don't want to act like liberals and progressives think much about systems either, because they don't. But when it comes to the individuals shunning socialism or anything, commonwealth, communism, anything like that, which says that the social good is to be the primary focus, their support for constantly slashing domestic programs tells you how dangerous their ideology is. Because if you don't even believe that the federal government's, one of its basic jobs is to provide funds so that municipalities, counties, and states can operate at a very high functioning level. If you don't even believe that, then you are essentially saying that what you want is a brass form of anarchy. Now, not all anarchy is brass. You can have anarchy which is federated. You have all these individual commonwealth groups that are federated together into one larger commonwealth. The type of anarchy that they seek is cruder. They want each community fighting amongst itself. So they essentially want us to go back to a time period where it's regional city-states fighting always for economic resources, economic dominance and prominence, and it's pretty much a war footing all the time for those regional places. Now, of course, none of them will admit this. All of them will say, no, that's not what we want. But when you look at what their policies, their actions, and what they're advocating is going to bring about, you can actually see this happening. And none of them will admit this. None of them will admit this. But you kind of see the formation of it with the, I call them death cults, but they're not really doomsday preppers. Doomsday preppers. You can see this kind of with doomsday preppers, because doomsday preppers, all of them are about, okay, bringing in their clan, bringing in everybody who they know, and then it's going to be them versus the rest of society as society falls apart, and they're going to have to protect their own, and they might have to fight against these people who have resources and these people who have resources so they can survive or the other people can survive, and it's going to be just mano a mano, group versus group. And so some of these doomsday preppers are creating networks where there's a doomsday prep group in Kansas, and there's maybe three of them, and they're networked together, and then there's a couple of them in Missouri, and then they're networked together, but they're not the only doomsday preppers, though. There's other groups in those same states which are not in the same network. So now you have opposing factions. So when society starts breaking down, maybe they might all get together as one group, but then there's going to be other groups out there that they're going to have to be wary about and fight about. I'm trying to think, there's, what is that show where everyone's turned into zombies? And pretty much this is what they, this is their vision of utopia. This crazy social ridiculousness which really resembles the Middle Age. And by that, I actually mean the Middle Ages, where everybody had a regional piece, a city-state, and then each city-state either was at peace or was at war. This is what they are creating. I'm not, you know, you might listen to this and say, oh, that's ridiculous, that's ridiculous. But think about it. Think about it. Right now, for the last 40 years, conservatives have been talking about state rights, and having each state compete. They've literally said this, each state compete for the support of industry by having to adjust their tax laws and what have you to attract corporations. So they already have states working against one another. In larger states, you actually have regional economic authorities already. I live in one of them. I'm in New York State. We have regional economic authorities. You have to. It's, you know, you have different economic needs for each locale. But you're even starting to see where individual cities and individual states are competing against one another to attract corporations to their municipalities. In Central and Western New York, we have four cities actually. One probably doing the best out of the four. Buffalo, Rochester, Syracuse, and Albany. And I know there's smaller cities in between there, but seriously, these are the larger cities. So, Rochester, outside of Buffalo, which has the Bills, is really doing economically decent. I'm not talking about the black areas. The black areas are rarely doing good. I'm talking about where white people frequent. And I know, I don't believe Rochester was ever in the running for the Amazon headquarters, but with the Amazon headquarters, you see how the city-states would work. You see the cities going all in all, just going all out to attract this corporation, to bring this corporation into their fold, and really cutting away basic services to do it. A lot of these tax plans that these cities are presenting to Amazon undermine the health and well-being of the people living in the city, to ensure that there are jobs. Yes, what it basically does is it. I was going to say yes, there's going to be jobs, but what it basically does is it shifts the tax burden that the company, the corporation, would actually be paying to the people who are going to be working there. And that is important, because a company like Amazon, who, you know, it's kind of funny, they keep saying Amazon is going to be the first $1 trillion company. Here's the funny thing. In 1999, 1998, they were saying Walmart was going to be the first $1 trillion company. Walmart never made it. Amazon might, but Walmart never made it. But if you have a company like Amazon, which I think they said they're guaranteeing 50,000 jobs at that new headquarters, and then there might be, you know, some warehouse expansions and stuff. But you have 50,000 jobs. Let's say that, on average, you know, with the people at the top of the company working there and the people at the bottom, let's say it's $100,000 per person who's living there. So that's, what, about $5 billion? That's into the local economies. That's a lot of money. But if that plant generates $100 billion each year, let's say, it's Amazon, for God's sakes, it's probably going to do somewhere when it's really up and functioning and running, it's going to be $250 billion. So you have a asset there that's generating $250 billion. Even if the company, which Amazon right now, from some of the proposals that I saw, pretty much they're going to be walking tax-free for at least 10 years. 10 years. So if you are making, and I know it's going to take a little bit of while for them to get up to $250 billion, but let's say they get up there. And so after 10 years, they're making $250 billion. So the next 10 years, it's probably going to be, they're probably going to pay 1 or 2% tax on all of that earning. Because $250 billion, you probably imagine 150 to 200 is going to be nothing but profit. I guarantee it. But they're only paying 1 to 2% on tax for that. So they're paying $2 billion, where they should be paying 30%. Look at the difference in those numbers. So even if the people who are making the $5 billion in salaries and payments, and wages, excuse me, if they're making $5 billion, they're still paying their 25 and 30% to the federal government and to the state. While this big behemoth over here, who's making hundreds of billions of dollars, are not. This, you're undercutting the health and well-being of the community to serve this corporation. Which actually makes sense when you think about it, because I keep telling you, corporations are nothing but cancer cells. That's all they are. And actually, something interesting, I discovered something very interesting. I won't get into that, because then that's going to fly me off onto another whole thing. But corporations are cancer cells. All they do is they suck up resources and they kill anything that they attach to. And we need to understand that. So the world that these folks who keep saying socialism is bad, the world that they want, is one where it's just constant battle and fighting and struggling and all of that. Where the world that socialists want is actually pretty peaceful. Have you ever actually read the proposals for the Socialist Party USA, or even the Communist Party of, I think it's North America, back in 2011, and again in 2012, and again in 2016, I actually did that. And I did it not because I'm a card-carrying member of the Communist Party or the Socialist Party, but because people like to trash socialism and communism. I am a socialist. I like socialism. I like socialism. I do. I've read enough on it to understand what its possibilities are. I've also understood what its limitations are, considering that it was conceived in Europe, but it was put into practice in Africa. It's always been put into practice in Africa and in native communities throughout the world. So I read the platforms of both of those parties to kind of get an idea of what they really, really wanted. The limitations that I found, by the way, is that ultimately, Europe has always been a caste-driven society. It's always been that way. And so, even though the fundamentals are correct that they talk about, it is likely, because of how Europe's history has been over the last 3,000-4,000 years, that most of the people, it would take at least a generation, maybe two generations, to really get them comfortable with the idea of having a commonwealth and being in a commonwealth and dealing with people on a commonwealth basis. It would be a dramatic shift. It could be done. You know, it could take 20 years, but it could be done. But it would still take a while. What these people advocate, outside of some of the philosophical stuff that they talk about, is less war, which I don't understand why conservatives are so hell-bent on just constant war, constant war, constant war. Is not equality, because it's not about equality ultimately. And if you have to actually look up the word what equality means, but do it from a standpoint of science, not just in your regular dictionary. Go and look up equality in a scientific dictionary. Mathematical and Physics Dictionary, that's the one that I actually have. And what you'll find is equality, when you look at it from a scientific standpoint, is really impossible, because it has to do with setting everything in order and making almost everything static. And that's just not going to happen. We are very different people. But what they do advocate is treating everybody in a manner which could be called equal, so that you will always have a place in society, and society will always have a place for you. There's a lot of work that needs to actually be done in a society that you can't make a profit off of, and you shouldn't make a profit off of. I'll give you a great example of this. Where I live, we have a robust recycling program. It's free of charge. You don't have to pay for it. And every week they come around, they collect all your recycling, and then they go and they, you know, recycle it. Now, in the same community, which my research is correct on that, this is a community project. I think they hire a company to actually do the recycling, but it's still a community project. I look at recycling as a commonwealth. I think it should be literally put into law. Every community, maybe every county, has a recycling program. It is free of charge, and it covers everything. And that at a regional level, there should be a body of researchers that actually researches ways to constantly recycle other materials. I'm not just talking about reusing them. I'm talking about breaking them down and recycling them. But in my same community, there is a big recycling corporation with, I think they have a dozen or so locations. I remember I worked for a company where they changed how they were recycling, and we actually had to sit in on a presentation on how they were changing their recycling, and they changed the company that they were using, and this company was being brought in. But this company makes hundreds of millions of dollars each year, literally, recycling. However, they only employ about 1,200 people to do it, and I think, like I said, I think they have a dozen locations. Now, that shows you the fundamental problem of making recycling a major industry. Because there are certain things that you are going to, it's going to be more cost effective not to recycle, but it's going to be harmful to the environment. So you want to recycle them. But you may not be able to make a profit if you do. A great example of this is computers or electronics. Or even tires. Most of the time with tires, they'll just make them into other things. When really, if you could find a way to take tires, break them down into their original elemental structures, and then repurpose them, that would be a far better use for the material. But it's not cost effective. So in socialism, because one of the tenets of socialism is to care for the environment, because we live in the environment, the cost effectiveness wouldn't stop you from doing that. You would just absorb the cost into the community and the society. So if to implement a program nationally of breaking down things that would be harmful to the environment in order to recycle them, let's say it costs $25 billion to implement this thing all around the country with an operating cost of another $15 billion each year. That cost, so the initial $25 billion would be absorbed by what we call the federal government. They would actually put that money forward to put the plan into process. And then the additional $15 would either be absorbed by the federal government or would be absorbed by the states and the federal government. That's actually socialism. That's socialism. Now, it may be funny, but in government, government works that way anyway. The only difference is, whereas the capitalist government says we are going to absorb costs for the benefit of corporations and hope that corporations take care of the environment and takes care of the community, which often they don't. Because truthfully, corporations are cancer cells and they are made to be cancer cells. And they are made to suck the life and the profit out of everything that they touch. So whereas capitalist governments say, we're going to give all the breaks, we're going to absorb all the costs for the corporations, the socialist government says, no, we're going to absorb the cost for the community. Now, the problem that socialism has always run into is, how does it treat its economics? Socialism, contrary to what people like to think, is not an economic system. Ah, you didn't know that, did you? Socialism is not an economic system. Even though socialism treats economics a lot in its discussions, because politics is economics. Politics is economics. We don't talk about it anymore in this country, but we used to have a conversation about something called political economy. Google that phrase. Not only Google it, but you want to put into Google with it, put in 1800s, and just see the list of books and articles. They used to talk about political economy like we talk about sports. Politics is economics. Politics is wholly attached to economics. How your economic system is based is how your politics will be based. And in fact, you see this. Citizens United, if you understand that politics is economics, if you understand that, you will understand that Citizens United is not an outlier. It's not an outlier. It is, in fact, what a capitalist government would seek to do. It is what a capitalist government will seek to do. With socialism, how they treat their economics has been what has gotten it in trouble, because you have many different structures which you can implement with socialism. Personally, I believe if you're going to have a socialist government, you have to have cooperatives. You have to have cooperatives. That is the only viable attachment to socialism to make it actually work. You have to have cooperatives. And you have to have cooperatives that are both led by the individual. I apologize, I was interrupted. So, cooperatives have to both be motivated by individual mandates, because some people are real visionaries, and so they set forward a constitution, all of these stipulations, and then people can agree to that and agree to work for that. Now, some people, some capitalists insist that this is what corporations pretty much do, but this is not what corporations do. The difference, corporations set forward agendas and stuff, but people don't have a say in the direction of that corporation, whereas in a cooperative, you do. The initial mandates, when it is created by the individual, still have to follow the prescribed notion of you have power within this organization. But there's a little bit more leeway with the individual. So the individual may say, well, this is the vision which we are striving towards. And this is ultimately what the payoff is going to be for it. So this is how much you're going to be making and what have you. And with such a mandate, the person can either agree to it or not. They don't have to accept it. There's, of course, room for negotiation, but the individual who has the idea can actually set the tone for a while, but yet still has to allow for aspects of administration to be voted on by the people who are participating in it. So then there's the other side where it's a completely group effort. It's a complete group effort. And everything is decided by the group. The whole vision is decided by the group. The whole structure is decided by the group. And that is what most people think of when they think of cooperatives. Now, in this type of a society, the role of the socialist government is to ensure that there's a balance struck within for the cooperatives, and to maintain that balance so the cooperatives can continue to be cooperatives. So they won't have to compete against each other, per se. Now, in economics, there's always going to be some, a small level of competition. But the competition changes. Instead of, like in capitalism, the competition is to amass as much wealth and power and prestige as you can get, and then to knock down those who you see as your enemies. Within socialism, within the cooperative system, that's not what competition is for. Think about this. Competition, and I actually see this kind of trying to bud up today, and it's pretty strange because people want to poo-poo it and hate it, but this is really what the world needs. Competition in a socialistic society and with cooperatives is built around the idea of taking care of your society. So competition, think about this. Competition, when you make it into a commonwealth purpose, is about who can take care of the society better. Who can take care of the society better? And this then leads to responsibility. Think about that. Who can take care of the society better? And if your competitor, if not your competitor, but if other cooperatives aren't taking care of the society, if they're not taking care of their members, their participants, like they should be, it is your job as a cooperative, it is your responsibility to look at those cooperatives and say, no, you will not do that. That is harmful to this society. That is harmful to this community. I am going to expose you. That's what competition is for. In a cooperative economic system, it is to make you better. Yes. Yes. But it's also to keep you humble and to keep you doing right. So there's also, of course, the idea of innovating. And competition is for that too. So you don't take away the right to innovate. You want people to still have the right to innovate. But like this country was in its early days, instead of giving people 70 years copyright and patent and all of that nonsense, you give them 10 or 15. And I don't even think you give them 15. You give them 10. And so that innovative piece, you can utilize that, and I won't even say 10, I'd say 5. You can use that innovation for yourself for 5 to 10 years. And then it's the communities. And then it's the communities. This is socialism. This is socialism. This is cooperative. This is what the wealthy fear. Because this then creates a culture of caring. When they talk about, oh, the culture of welfare, oh, this is so frightening to them, it is because it is through fear that they rule. It is through fear that they rule. Now, I'm going to take a brief break, and then I'm going to be back to speak with you about more of this.
Just 105 days until the country votes in the midterm elections, have you noticed how obsessed some conservatives have become with Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez? She, of course, is the Democratic Socialist who won an upset victory last month, surprised everyone, in Democratic primary in New York's 14th congressional district. And the day after she won, Trump TV's Sean Hannity put up this amazing graphic lamenting her gender with her absolutely shocking support for women's rights, fighting climate change, and supporting seniors. Ocasio-Cortez has recently been in the Midwest campaigning for progressive candidates alongside Bernie Sanders, which prompted another round of conservative hand-wringing. The conservative Fox Business Network tweeted out a portion of one speech without comment in what appeared to be a warning about these words from the scary socialist.
We will not rest until every person in this country is paid a living wage to lead a dignified life.
chilling stuff. An editor of the Conservative Daily Caller went to one of the rallies, writing that she, quote, saw something truly terrifying. I saw how easy it would be as a parent to accept the idea that my children deserve health care and education. She elaborated on Trump TV this morning.
They talk about things that everybody wants, especially like if you're a parent. They talk about education for your kids, health care for your kids, the things that you want. And, you know, if you're not really paying attention to how they're going to pay for it or, you know, the rest of that, it's easy to fall into that trap and say, my kids deserve this. And, you know, well, maybe the government should be responsible for helping me with that.
So what is it about this woman that has the right so worked up? What does it mean for the midterms and beyond? Joining me now, New York Times columnist Michelle Goldberg, whose latest column is headlined, Democrats are moving left, don't panic. Also with me, MSNBC contributor Sam Seder, host of The Majority Report, and Brianna Gray, senior politics editor at The Intercept, whose latest piece is headlined, Bernie Sanders and Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez went to war with partisanship in Kansas. What do you think? You're a longtime connoisseur, fetishist for conservative media, somewhere in between.
That's fair. I think there's a couple of things. One is they have spent years and years saying that Barack Obama is a secret socialist.
Right.
This person's a secret socialist, and it was the secret part that sort of created the suspicion. When it's out in the open, it becomes a lot more difficult for them to deal with.
Because it scrambles the wires.
It scrambles the wires. And so then there's this other element of, like, it's so irresistible. Like, and this honestly, this was a formula they used with, forgive me, with gay sex.
Right.
There was a Dr. Paul Cameron who argued this. He was one of the foremost sort of anti-gay conservatives who wrote and opined that gay sex was the best sex. And therefore, it was that much more dangerous. And in some respects, that is like the same formula. Like, so enticing.
That's right.
That you could fall into this trap of actually wanting your kids to have health care.
Think they deserve to have it.
Right. I mean...
You were in that. Did you? Am I right that
I
you
did.
Were out there? You went and covered that rally.
I went to Kansas, and you know, keeping in mind that everyone said it wasn't going to work in the Midwest, and this was a complete waste of time and a disaster. You know, the venue had to be changed the night before because it sold out within 10 hours, and something like 4,000 people showed up at this bigger venue at 1 o'clock in the afternoon on a Friday in triple degree heat.
Yeah.
You know, that's not nothing.
That's not nothing.
And I think that the
doesn't mean that Kansas going to win. By the way.
No, it doesn't. And that's, none of this can be, you know, reduced in that way. But I think what it shows is that there's a message that is beyond partisanship. And when she talks about wanting to implement programs that speak to human dignity, that speak to basic material needs, people hear that and people understand that who might not otherwise associate themselves with one party or the other.
That's a good point. It sort of goes to what the Daily Caller person was saying, right? Because she was saying, like, none of the signals were there to tell me that this is a bad thing that I shouldn't like, and I can see people being... you know, seduced by it.
Exactly.
I mean, I actually disagree that that goes beyond partisanship, right? I mean, I think you have one whole political party that has that genuinely does find this kind of language threatening and quasi-totalitarian and believes that, you know, first you're talking about children deserving health care, the next second you're being re-indoctrinated in FEMA camps. But I think that in as much as there are swing voters, and there are not very many swing voters anymore, you know, an electorate this polarized, every election is a base election, but in as much as there are swing voters, they're not the kind of people that Beltway types like to pretend they are, these kind of judicious centrists, carefully considered.
Cross-pressured
on the
issues.
Those are the people, I think, who kind of are most motivated by appeals to their sort of basic material needs.
Let me just also say one thing here, which just to be clear. She also has a tremendous amount of distinct political talent. Mm-hmm. I mean, like, just to be clear, like, these people are not out of thin air. Like, she is very good at doing this. That doesn't just, like, that's a little beyond the message.
Without a doubt. But I don't mean to repeat myself, but I think the policy prescriptions are almost secondary. There's nothing offensive in what she's saying in terms of, like, people wanting their kids to have health care. But I think the idea that it is being straightforward, that is completely laid out there, speaks to the whole broader issue that, you know, politicos don't necessarily contemplate, but it's just like, basically, like, do I think that person is authentic? Are they telling me what they believe? They are, and they seem to be pretty confident about it. And I think that goes a lot further than we imagine.
I think there's something to the delivery, of course, but you can't also ignore that something like 70% of all congressional candidates who are in swing districts, Democrats, who have won, ran centering health care as the central policy. When I was in Kansas, I got a ride home from the airport with a 75-year-old Trump voter and her daughter. And when I asked her, you know, what she was doing, because she talked to me about how she appreciated that her grandkids could be on healthcare longer because of Obamacare. She appreciated that she was on Medicare and when it was all about Medicare expansion. She was concerned that both of her adult children were living at home, couldn't get a living wage, and didn't have healthcare. And when I explained to her that I was going to a Bernie rally and these are the things that Bernie cared about, it didn't take but a 10-minute car ride to get her on board.
Right.
And I think that you can't undervalue the fact that people don't have to be policy wonks to understand that basic policies that enable them to live a life in a wealthy and moral America, as Ocasio-Cortez says, matter. And they've been a disservice to not have had them all these years.
This is the Joe Lieberman column, who is a sort of like perfect kind of
healthcare hero.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, Joe Lieberman, who said people should vote for Joe Crowley, who's still on the ballot for the Working Families Party, because Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez hurts the party, Congress, and even America. I think one of the things that she does here, which gets this right, which is like, there's always the like, but how are you going to pay for it, right? Or like, oh yeah, it sounds great to like do all this stuff, but like, let's be real. And I think part of the path that has been plowed by the Republicans is like, why are you even going to talk about that?
Right.
Why play that game? The president just pulled $12 billion out of thin air to like basically make some cash payments to the farmers. He's screwing with his trade policy. Like, why even play the game?
Right. And I think that also she's has kind of parried that question really well, which is we're laying out a marker for the kind of society that we want to create. Right. I'm not kind of coming to you with a white paper about legislation that I'm going to introduce next year.
The problem is that the
faux concern about the deficit, and we can argue as to whether or not there's money. I mean, they came up with $70 billion a year for the military.
Right.
We didn't need that.
Right.
But the notion of the deficit is no longer one of those sort of signifiers, one of those cultural IDs that like guns, God, it used to be the deficit. And that
got cast aside.
That got cast aside very quickly.
Well, last thing though, I will say here, right? Like, so, you know, there's obviously, this is someone who's running, who's gonna probably win, I think, in her district, it's Bronx and Queens, very liberal district, majority people of color. You've got like Connor Lamb, and you got people running in very different ways. Like, I'm not quite sold on the idea, right? Like the thesis here, right? The Bernie like thesis is like, this is universal stuff. You can go out to Kansas and do it. And I'm not quite sold yet that is true.
Well, what if we look at the fact that Bernie Sanders won every district in the primary in West Virginia?
Right.
What if we look at
primaries,
how...
Those are primaries,
but Hillary won Mississippi. Like, that doesn't mean that her brand of politics is viable there.
No, because a general election and a primary election are very different.
Right.
People are choosing based on pure partisanship in a general election. And I think that being overly dismissive of people on the ground who articulated a choice for a more progressive vision of the world, who articulated a choice for policies that spoke to their genuine material concerns, is a fool's errand.
Whether it's a fool's errand or not, I'm just saying it is an unanswered question, right? About like the I'm going to go run as a socialist
but
in Kansas, and that's going to work.
I think these tensions are somewhat overplayed, right? I mean, every district will sort of choose somebody who's appropriate. I have no opinion about this primary in Kansas. I do know that when I was in Pennsylvania, I met people who worked for both Connor Lamb and also for some of the socialist candidates who won
Pittsburgh,
state house,
right.
And they, you know, kind of, they didn't see them as being on opposite sides of some kind of great divide.
Michelle Goldberg, Sam Cedar, and Brianna Gray, thank you both for being with me tonight.
All right, so I'm back. Ultimately, we are approaching socialism. We are approaching the idea of the cooperative within the socialism, within the socialist society, which is the government. Don't ever forget, socialism is not an economic plan, though, because within politics, there's always economics. When we are approaching socialism and we are approaching cooperatives, This is a major shift in cultural attitude, because ultimately the socialist government does have a welfare mindset. Now, we have been trained, and I mean this literally, we have been trained by the media to see welfare as a problem. But as I keep saying, if you notice, in a lot of my episodes, I'll say to you, research this, look this up, and I mean it. I understand we don't have a lot of time to ourselves, but there are certain things that you really have to take 10 minutes out of the day to familiarize yourself with, and this is one of them. You have to look up what the phrase welfare actually means. And I encourage you always, go to archive.org, archive.org, archive.org. Look up Noah Webster's, I think it's 1828 dictionary, and download it. It's in two volumes. Download it. And then you want to look up the phrase welfare. You want to go to Amazon, and I personally have four sets of dictionaries. Truthfully, try to buy a Random House dictionary that was published before 1975, a large Random House dictionary. And also try to find a Funks and Wagnalls dictionary. I've said this before, from prior to 1970. They should also be in two volumes. And then compare it, because most of us do have a dictionary, a modern dictionary in our homes or apartments or what have you. And I want you to compare some of the definitions. You'll see how watered down our understanding has become. But you want to look up in these dictionaries what the phrase welfare actually means. And what you'll realize is, in Europe, they have a great concept of welfare. They understand welfare as meaning exactly what it says. Well-faring. Meaning you are faring well. You are doing well. And so the government's job is to create an atmosphere and an environment where you not thrive, but you prosper. And you have not the opportunity to prosper, because opportunity doesn't mean nothing. You have the opportunity to die every day. Doesn't mean that you're going to do it. You have the opportunity to kill yourself at any moment. Doesn't mean you're going to do it. Opportunity is squat. No. You have the potential. You are given the potential to prosper. Meaning you are given every single thing that you need to prosper. Everything. Oh, well, that takes the competition out of it, and that's a nanny state. Really? That's funny, because the wealthy don't seem to think of it that way. Look at the legislation that has been passed for the wealthy in a capitalist society just over the past 10 years. And what you see is that the state is nannying capitalism. When in 2008 the world was going to explode because there was a banking crisis, the country, the government, came in, swooped in, and gave literally trillions of dollars to the banks. That wasn't called a welfare handout. That wasn't called a nanny state. That was called the job of the government. Well, guess what? That was welfare. That was a nanny state right there. That's not bad. When the government gives an oil depreciation allowance, which is paying companies which dig up oil from the ground for actually using the oil up, that's not a nanny state. That's just government doing what government should do. This is insane. Welfare is only bad when it's for the public. Well, what socialism says is that's not true. Welfare is for everybody. Everybody needs to fare well in a society. It's not just about the small group at the top. It's not. And this is what they fear. This is honest to God what they fear, because when you really do get into a commonwealth and well, and by the way, truthfully, when you combine socialism, the socialist government, and the cooperative economic ideas, which is really about the idea of welfaring and taking care of the whole, and not ignoring the individual. The individual can still be individualistic, but in all we do think about the prosperousness of our community, which, although people don't like to think about it, but that's exactly what we all desire. I mean, kids desire that at a very young level, at a very young age. But so, when you really think about it and you put both of those two things together, the socialist government and the cooperative economics, what you get is a commonwealth attitude for your state. This might truthfully be egalitarianism. People call it socialism, but socialism is how you govern. Nobody really talks about the flip side. The political aspect is socialist. But what about the economic? Let's say the economic is just, we'll call it cooperatives for the moment, for the time being. Well, what is the two put together? What is the entire society called? I would say it's called a commonwealth. I would say it's called a commonwealth. And why is this so fundamentally, this might even, by the way, this on the other level, you would also have democracy. And so this might just be really democracy in its whole form. So maybe it's not a commonwealth. Maybe it's truthfully how a democracy would run. Because on the flip side, you have capitalism. And so capitalism is the political system, even though it could also be called the economic system. It's kind of weird. Let me back that up. Capitalism is not the political system. Capitalism is the economic system. But in order to allow capitalism to flourish and to thrive, because it really does thrive, it doesn't flourish, it's parasitic. In order to allow that to happen, what kind of government do you need? People say, oligarchical, maybe. Authoritarian, not necessarily authoritarian, even though there are many aspects of authoritarianism in our government right now, and has been, really, for quite some time. But I don't really know the answer to that. What kind of government do we truthfully have that supports capitalism? Because capitalism is not a political system. We don't have a democratic government, even though we like to think we do. But we don't. Most of the people who run for office are selected by a very, very small group of people. And so it's not democratic. Now, I was watching Mark Blythe, and he was talking about, he was invited to this swanky fundraiser or something he went to. And he asked a question. All the people in the room were, you know, millionaires beyond belief and billionaires. And he asked a question. He said, okay, how many of you in the room donate money or give money to campaigns? Every hand shot up except for, as he put it, the presidents of colleges, because colleges can't engage in that. And then he said, okay, that's cool. How many of you would actually employ one of the politicians that you have supported financially in your organization and have them run your organization? Almost all of their hands dropped. Almost all of their hands dropped and a laughter erupted. And Mark Blythe said, you know, don't think that's funny. I mean, think about the caliber of person that you're putting up to run the government. So you're paying all this money. These people are paying all this money to these other folks to run for office and to run this government. And yet, they wouldn't employ these same people in their organization to run the organization. I can't remember who said it, but they said that basically we live in a kleptocracy where you're just stealing everything you can, which makes sense. But imagine that. So in a socialistic society, there in your constitution, there would literally be strict guidelines what a person must meet to actually run for office. Or at least, I would hope there would be. And there would be a level of competency which people would have to shoot for. Whether it's directly in your constitution or the papers that kind of come from the constitution. And what I mean by the papers that come from the constitution, there's many of you don't know about these things. They're called USC, United States Codes, and they're extensive. And pretty much what those codes are instructions for running the government and running aspects of the government. Most people don't even know they exist, but they are massively extensive. There are, I'm thinking there are tens of thousands of them, but I've only seen maybe references which shoot it up past 10,000, so I don't know exactly how many they are, but they exist and you can get a hold of them. But there would be, and I would definitely put it into the Constitution, there would be definition put forward for what each candidate, you know, the competency level of each candidate. Today, we don't necessarily have that. So now, of course, the fear creeps in because wealthy people and individuals who like the idea of constantly battling and fighting, they look at something like this and they say, oh, well, this is just unnatural. This is completely unnatural. I look at the state of this society and I ask them, what is unnatural? What is unnatural? Are people running around constantly trying to build themselves up to thrive natural? People are tired. People are tired. I mean this. I look and people are tired. I talk to people. People are angry. They are so angry, they are angry that they are angry because they are angry. And they don't even know what to do about that anger. They don't know how to define it. They don't know how to break it down. They don't know how to motivate themselves beyond it. It clouds their judgment. I've been there. You know, there are some political things that strike me in such a way where I really need to, like, move back from it so I can discuss it with myself and then figure out how to approach it. Anger clouds the mind sometimes if you don't know how to channel it and you don't know how to interpret it. And most of these folks don't know how to interpret it. I'm not saying that the people who I'm talking about who are against socialism don't know how to interpret it. They've already interpreted it. It is against their own best interest, but they've already interpreted it. I'm saying that the masses of the people don't know how to interpret it. They are angry, and they don't know how to interpret it. This system which we are living in is unnatural. It's not even just unnatural for nature. It is unnatural for us. Constantly beating each other up to try to get ahead is unnatural. It is, truthfully, it's the handle of a psychopath. Well, no, I think that's a little extreme. Even though, truthfully, capitalism is more fit for psychopaths. But the system operates off of scarcity. The system operates off of the principle of scarcity, and that there's constant scarcity. And so everybody's supposed to be afraid that they're not going to get their stuff, get their needs met. So then they work harder to get their needs met. I've heard people argue that that is why socialism doesn't work, because everybody has to get their needs met. Well, yes, everybody does. But you don't need to work yourself half to death to do it. Scarcity is a myth. Scarcity does not exist anymore. It doesn't. It does not exist. I'm not being overdramatic about this. Scarcity just does not exist. There is so much overproduction that the rules of this economic system don't even apply sometimes to what is happening. For instance, the rules of capitalism say if you have far more of something than is needed, prices should drop dramatically. This just isn't true half the time. This just isn't true half the time. Give you a great example. A couple of years ago, I purchased a flag. And I paid about $10 for that flag. The flag, looking at it, probably cost less than $2 to make. I'm confident the place that I bought the flag at, they could have easily sold the flag for $4, maybe $5. They made a profit. I paid $10 plus tax. Broken rule already. But an even greater one, when Harry Potter was issuing its last book, The price was reasonable, but it was also a little steep. I think it was $20-something. So capitalism says, the rule says, that if there's high demand but low availability, price should be pretty decently high. But if there's high demand and high availability, then price should be relatively low. Now, there's kind of an out when it comes to certain things where they say, well, high demand, high availability, you know, then you can charge almost what you want because you're the two lines are intersecting. And so you don't want to gouge the people, but you can still set prices high enough where you can make a really good profit. Well, here's the problem with that. Your first logical explanation of capitalism is that it exists to order things in a way that is going to be beneficial for both the corporation and the consumer. If you say that something, if you have high demand of something and high availability of something, that you can still charge whatever you want, then it's not beneficial to the customer. It's just beneficial to the corporation. And that's exactly what they did. They knew that they were going to need, I think it was 10 million books for Harry Potter's last book. And they printed them out. In fact, they had more than they needed, even though they still sold like 10 or 12 million books. That price should have actually been significantly lower. It didn't cost them much to print those books. So the price should have been significantly lower according to capitalist rules. But we're kind of getting off into major specifics there. Capitalism is unnatural. Now, some of the things that capitalism does, by the way, and the demand and availability curve, every economic system would have to deal with that. Every economic system would have to deal with that. So there are some things that you would obviously take from capitalism. The organizational principles of capitalism aren't all bad. But what it requires to sustain itself is the problem. That's the argument. And that's why it won't work. Honest to God, that's why it won't work. And why it's not going to work. You're going to see it fall in the next 10 to 20 years. I don't even think it's going to take 20 years. I don't believe it's going to take 20 years. I think you're seeing it already start to crack and crumble. And in the next 10 years, you're going to see it almost done away with. The question is it going to be a bloody end? Is it going to be a bloody end? Or is it going to be an end which is transitional without the bloodshed? That's the question. That is the question. Hopefully, I'm hoping it's not going to be a bloody end, but I'm with the reliance on guns and doomsday prepping and all of that, I'm pretty confident there's probably going to be a conflict, and it's not going to be favorable to this country. I'm hoping not. I really am hoping not, but it seems likely that there will probably be a conflict. So we need to be watchful and mindful of that. All right, so this concludes today's episode. I'm hoping you enjoyed it. I hope it gave you a lot to think about. Especially in the realm of socialism, because socialism is really a topic of hot discussion. And truthfully, most conservatives don't check into it. They just feed their paranoias. I got to grow up at the end of the USSR. And by the time, you know, I was in third grade, the USSR was no more. And I was where, you know, I was hearing a lot about socialism without anyone ever actually explaining what it was. And I was hearing that capitalism was the greatest thing since sliced bread. So I should be 100% for capitalism. But I see the limitations of it. And maybe I see the limitations of it because ultimately, as a black male, I am fundamentally able, because, you know, I see the limitations of the system and how it treats me, I am fundamentally able to perceive the problems because those problems so vastly negatively impact me. That might be it. But whatever it is, we have to realize that we're at a crossroads. I know people say this so much, and I've said it a couple of times, but from a spiritual standpoint, to be at a crossroads isn't about a moment in time. Usually, it's about a period of time. So the crossroads, I'll give a great example. In the 60s, the 60s was a crossroads period where decisions that were undertaken were going to have wide-ranging impact. Nobody knew how, but that was what the 60s was about. And then the 70s was kind of an extension where the decisions made at the higher levels of the society in the 60s were then implemented in the 70s to a great extent, and the country convulsed because of it. Another crossroads would be the 1930s, where decisions that were going to have wide-ranging effect were being made at both the ground level and the top level, and then in the 40s, and actually World War II kind of shifted that ground. So whereas the decisions in the 30s would have been implemented in the 40s throughout that decade, because of World War II, much of that implementation had to wait until 45 to 55. And that's why you had the Red Scare and everything, because they wanted the decisions at the top were not in harmony with the decisions at the bottom. And so they had to knock out those elements at the bottom of society which were making different decisions in order to put their plan into effect. Now, what's funny about that is almost immediately you've seen disharmony take place. And so then you had another cycle of decision making, which was the 60s. And after those two cycles were implemented, you had the 80s. And so we've been living with those cycles. We've been living with those decisions, should I say, after they've been completed. We are now in a period of time, and I think really, I'd like to say it's now that we're at the crossroads, but maybe we are literally entering it in the next few years, where decisions that we make on the ground level will have such far-reaching impact that we can't even comprehend it right now. The 2020s is going to be a hot decade. It's going to be a hot decade. I'm not talking just weather, because I believe that's going to be happening. We are where I sit right now. I'm sitting in central New York. We, right now, it's about 35 degrees. 2 days from now, it's going to be 61. Last year, we had a string of 60, I don't know if it got to 70s, but I know it was 50s and 60s, days in February. That was just, it was unheard of. It was spring-like in February for a couple of weeks, to the point where I walked to work, or walked to catch the bus to work anyway, with a short sleeve shirt on and, you know, no coat. It was insane. It's going to be a hot decade in the 2020s. But I also think it's going to be a hot political decade, where many things are going to be up in the air. Many things are going to have the ability to change. And either we are going to be active participants in it, either we're going to be active participants in it, or we're going to be passive participants in it. And if we are going to be passive participants, then we are going to be siding with evil. I think the wealthy know this. Like I've said many times before, and I know some people think it's insane that I keep saying it, but they have oracles. Oracles are telling them what the stars are saying and what the energy in this country is saying. They know that there's about to be confrontation. The conservatives know there's about to be confrontation, and they're preparing for that. They are. So it's going to be a hot decade, and we have to be ready for that. All right, so now I am really done, okay? I am really done. If you have any questions, comments, concerns, you know, reach out to me. Let me know what you think. I always love hearing from you guys. It has been a while since I've uploaded something. Here we go. I hope this suffices and satisfies, all right? Have a good time until I talk with you again. This is your brother, Vladimir Deez. Peace. There's a shadow on the faces of the men who sent the guns to the wars that are fought in places where their business interest runs. On the radio, talk shows, and the TV, you hear one thing again and again. How the USA stands for freedom
and we come to the aid of a friend. But who are the ones that we call our friends? These governments killing their own, or the people who find they can't take anymore, and they pick up a gun or a brick or a stone. And there are lives in the balance.
Thank you.